Welcome to ApplauseCast. Tonight, Larry Habiger of Traveler's Tales and Stephen Mara of ApplauseCast interview Simon Winchester on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the Great San Francisco Earthquake of 1906. This is part two of a two-part interview. Simon Winchester is the author of some 20 books, including the bestseller Krakatoa, The Map That Changed the World, Outpost, The Professor and the Madman, Korea, and The Meaning of Everything. His most recent book, A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906, is the subject of an online excerpt reading available at www.applausecast.com. We joined Simon Winchester in his room in the Palace Hotel on April 15, 2006, with our hosts Larry Habiger of Traveler's Tales and Stephen Mara of ApplauseCast.
That leads me to a question, a more general question about your career, which I would say varied and storied. You've been a foreign correspondent for the Sunday London Times and other papers. You were the Asia correspondent or Asia editor for Condé Nast Traveler. You've written in the neighborhood of 20 books, maybe more, maybe a few less, I'm not sure. You are trained as a geologist, and you are at this point, I would guess, able to write about almost anything that you want, and you write books about whatever you want. So the question is, how did you get here? How did you get to this point to where you're able to do pretty much any kind of project that you'd like to do?
That's very difficult. I think, and if this is something that, you know, aspiring writers would be listening to, I think the key to it all is persistence. Just don't give up and keep hammering away at what interests you. I think if my books have been successful, and recent ones have, and it's because I think I convey my enthusiasm for a subject to people. I think I only write about what really interests me. And if it interests me, I think, at least at this point in my career, how long it'll last for, I don't know, I seem to be able to convey that enthusiasm to people. And that's fun for everybody, because it's... It enables me to sell books, and it enables me to write with a great feeling of joy. I mean, I love what I do. I get up every morning and I look forward to going in there and writing. I'm doing a book on China at the moment, and I'm having such fun with it.
That's the best thing you could say, that you have fun with it, and it continues to be fun.
Yeah, it really does. I don't look upon it as a burden or a chore. Mm-hmm. And I think if it did, I think that the reader would find that out pretty quickly.
Do you think that working as a newspaper correspondent and then a magazine correspondent gave you a certain skill or way of working that has helped you with your book writing?
It's certainly given me a discipline. I mean, I am very disciplined. I mean, frighteningly so when I'm writing a book. But it's because, you know, you've got a story to write, you've got to do 800 words, and it's got to be in by 6 p.m., otherwise, you know, the presses are going to roll. Mm-hmm. It's the unsympathetic attitude of the presses and your news editor. I mean, the people at The Guardian and then later at The Sunday Times were unforgiving curmudgeons, and if you didn't get the story in on time, then you're moved out of the way, and someone who can deliver the goods is in your place quicker than you can say,
so
Jack Robinson.
Are you still sending... I mean, I read in how you actually write, where you've got essentially a spreadsheet, and by a certain date you want this many pages done. I mean, you've got a process and a quantity and associated with a point in time.
Yes, I mean, I have to slightly defend myself. I don't think of words as just shoveling coal from one heap into another. But if I know that the contract calls for 150,000 words, which is what the new book has, then I will have worked out the structure that, you know, the first 10,000 is a sort of prologue and then build up to the story. And I mean, with the San Francisco book, I deliberately, and some people will say that it was a very badly structured book, but it was intentionally structured that I didn't get into the actual earthquake until about page 250, that I wanted to put it all in a very elaborate contextual framework. But all that is worked out ahead of time, and then it's a question of shoveling the coal, if you like. Then I put this counter at the top left of the computer saying 150,000 words to go, and I have 100 days to do it in, which means, in other words, 1,500 words a day. And at the end of each day, I will count up, see how many words left, what the word rate is the next day to accomplish my goal, and so on it goes. Rather like one of those rowing machines, you know, the guy is always trying to keep ahead of your target boat.
So in that scenario where you've got 1,500 words a day until the book is due, how do you factor in time to review and revise and reshape?
Well, I do it like this. The barn where I work is about 100 yards from the house where I live in Massachusetts. I don't write at all in New York City. So I get up every morning at 5:30 and I make myself a cup of tea and I walk over to the barn. I get there at about 5:45. I sit down and I look at what I had written the day before and I read it. And I often stand up and read it out loud because I think that is one of the keys. If you find you're standing up and boring yourself by what you're reading, then it's going to bore the reader. So I will sit down, rework it, polish it until about 8:00. And at 8:00, I will print it. And then I will leave and go back to the house and have breakfast. And then I will read the New York Times or whatever, deliberately not think about the book. And I will get back to the study at about 9:30. And then I will write until about 4:30, essentially without a stop. And then at 4:30, I'll stop and will go out for a run or something, I mean, just to clear my mind totally. And then we'll have a shower, have a cup of tea, go back to the study and prepare, do the reading and prepare for what I know I've got to write the next day. And that takes till about 8:00. And then at 8:00, I'll call it a day and then I'll go and have dinner or go out to a movie or see friends or whatever. And then in the morning at 5:30, get up again and look at what I've written on that day, polish it, hone it, print it, so that slowly there's a pile of paper grows. And at first it's an essay, then it's a monograph, mm-hmm. then it's a pamphlet, then it's a paperback book, and then ultimately it's a book.
That's wonderful. And do you work 7 days a week, 5 days a week?
Seven really, yeah. Except if I find I'm really ahead of myself, having done more than the whatever the target number of words is, then I will have days off. Yeah. But I get on a roll, you know. Occasionally you get into, I know with the China book, which is very complicated, there are going to be places where I, not stuck in the sense of writer's block, but stuck in the sense of there's an insurmountable mass of research to be done on the next chapter, so I may have to do 2 or 3 days of additional reading and telephoning and that sort of thing.
Yeah, looking at The Crack in the Edge of the World as an example, and The Krakatoa as well, there's so much information in those books. They seem to be exhaustively researched. So I would find that a real challenge to have. I mean, do you have all that in your head before you start the writing?
No. I mean, I have it in my head on a day-to-day basis, yes.
Right.
But I always have 2 bookshelves to my left and right with all... I mean, I think I've got now an extremely good reference library. I mean, mm-hmm. it's my pride and joy. It's what I'd seek to preserve if ever the farm burned down. But to my left and the right are essentially all the books I could possibly need about San Francisco and geology and the science and the latest journals and papers and things. So they're all there just at hand. So it's quite easy to find out.
So you've done all the research before you sit down, but then you have that if you need to...
Yes, exactly. So the research would have been done over the previous, I think in the case of the timetable was I came over to San Francisco for 4 months from January to May 2004 when I was teaching at San Jose State. And then after I finished the research here, because it was connected, I drove up to Alaska and then drove back down to New York via Yellowstone because that's also geologically connected. So that took... that took about 6 months. And I remember getting back to New York on the 10th of June, or to Massachusetts on the 10th of June, and finishing the book on the 10th of December. So it took exactly 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the deadline, it was due on the 31st of December. So I just spent the next 21 days sort of reading it and mm-hmm. tweaking it and then send it off.
Was there much more work to do on it after I went to HarperCollins?
Structurally, no. In the case of the Krakatoa book, I think there was... We decided to move one chapter right to the beginning of mm-hmm. the book that had been in the center of the book. So there was a structural problem with the Krakatoa book. What goes on then is more than line editing. I mean, he would say, I remember standing on Mount Diablo at the beginning of the book and ruminating about the different area codes. And he said, no, I mean, this is ridiculous. This is pretentious. This is boring. And so that was about a page, which mercifully was lost. Otherwise, New York Times would have made even greater hay with that, I think.
You know, Simon, let me in terms of the way you're polishing it, one of my questions is your research, are you doing any of it online? Are you doing Google
Maps? Yes, some
Maps
of it.
And those types of things?
Yes. I mean, one of the nice things about being at San Jose State is that I got access to JSTOR, which is this document. It's basically all scientific documents from the year dot are there in PDF files. Costs a great deal unless you're a member of university, and Stanford, the people at Stanford let me get into JSTOR. So if I wanted a paper on, you know, 1907 view of the San Andreas Fault in the Bulletin of the Seismological Society of America, I could get it.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's a way of using the web. But would I do sort of Google searches and Wikipedia? Not really. I'd much prefer to go to the scientists that actually wrote the papers and bring them up. And I mean, this came up, for instance, in the very fast-moving world of the proto-continents, the early continents. Mm. I mean, we all know about Gondwanaland and Laurasia and Pangaea. But the ones before that, the earliest one was one called Ur. It was this strange sort of albatross-like agglomeration of scum, basically, which formed on the surface of the Earth about 2,000 million years ago, the first continent. Now, the man who recognized that is a very elderly professor at the University of North Carolina. So to ring him and have a long conversation with him was fascinating. You can get a little bit of information about Ur if you go to Wikipedia. Far better to go to the source.
My other question, in terms of the way you would polish and rewrite, let me just read a sentence to you that I liked. From there were many sentences I liked, but I mean, in particular, there's something about this sentence that kind of resonated. Many other towns similarly unburdened by excessive splendor. I read that and I thought many other authors would have said this town's a dump, this town is kind of shabby, but you said it in such, I don't know, a compelling kind of elegant way. Is this the way that sentence came out the first time you wrote it?
I think so. I mean, I'm afraid so, yes.
You see, ultimately, Simon is a really nice guy. Right. Yeah, he didn't want to offend anybody, right, in this village that that he described that way.
Do you do a lot of rewriting?
Polishing, yes. But I mean, I remember there was one phrase I was particularly proud of in the book, the only one I can remember. I remember the adjective I used, which was gasconading, talking about the bureaucrats in Monterey when this was, California was Mexican and the capital was Monterey. And I was talking about the gasconading, and I used another word instead of bureaucrats. And whatever that phrase was, I polished it and polished. I wanted to use the word gasconading because it's an unusual word, and I think it's a very attractive word. It just means having the sort of long neck of it means pompous. It means strutting about like a Gascon goose. And hardly anyone noticed it. So I worked hard, but to no effect.
Oh, I'm sure someone noticed it.
Someone did and has written about it. Yeah. An old lady, I think.
Well, one thing that is really predominant in your books is these wonderful characters that you capture and you convey to the reader. They're all over strewn throughout the books, and I think that's what makes your book so interesting to read, because they feel really anecdotal. Even though you might be talking about a somewhat esoteric science, you're peopling this world with characters, and I think that's a great appeal for your book. One scene that I thought was a very short thing, but a marvelous encounter that you had, I thought, was at the meteor crater outside Winslow, Arizona, when you, what was it, the Barringtons? You got
Barringer.
Barringer.
Minor Barringer. Shall I?
Yeah, please.
It was so funny. I was driving towards the meteor crater, which I'd never seen, and I thought I'd like to, and I imagined it was a National Park Service site, and therefore it would be beautifully maintained and sort of everything would be done tastefully. And I was sort of horrified when I was about 50 miles away to realize from the signage on the roads that it was not. It was privately owned, and I thought, oh my God, it's going to be a bit vulgar, full of, you know, statues of jackalopes and ghastly concession stands, and it'll be really tacky. I turned off whatever the road was, I-10 or something, and made my way to the meteor crater. And everything about it looked like the National Park Service. It was done scrupulously. I mean, it was completely beautiful. The visitor center was nice. The exhibitions were great. And the guides were nice, knowledgeable people. So we went up onto the lip of the crater. You're not allowed to go down anymore into the center of it, which was a pity for me, because I remember at university looking at these two substances called stishovite and coazite, which are two forms of quartz, which are caused when an enormous piece of iron slams into the Earth's surface, and for a few seconds there's intense heat and pressure, and quartz is turned into an allotrope, as it's called, coazite and stishovite. And I wanted to be able to go down and pick up a piece and say, I've got this rare substance that I studied all those years ago. But anyway, you're not allowed down into the bottom of the crater anymore. So we're standing up on the lip of it, and the guide is talking about how this crater is owned by a family in Philadelphia called Barringer. And I realized at that moment that I knew a rather wealthy family in Philadelphia called Barringer, and I thought maybe there's some connection. I didn't have their telephone number on me, but I knew someone in London that knew them very well. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, winter's day in Arizona. It's therefore 7 o'clock at night in London. So I called my friend. No, it's not 7 o'clock, it's later, 10 o'clock at night in London. I called this woman, Juliet Walker, and I said, do you know Minor Barringer's telephone number in Chad's Ford, just between Wilmington and Philadelphia? She said, yes, why? And I said, well, I just think that I may be on a piece of real estate in which they have some financial interest. So I then called, they're called Molly and Minor. They're both very old, very rich, and very nice. So I called, and the phone was answered by Minor. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening in Philadelphia. And he barked into the phone, yes, who is it? And I said, it's Simon. Who? Simon, I said. Molly, turn down the bloody television, will you? So eventually Molly acquiesced. He said, now, who is it? I said, it's Simon. He said, Simon, dear boy, I thought you were going to call in when you drove past on your way from Massachusetts. Where are you? And I said, well, where I am is why I'm calling you. I'm standing on the lip of the meteor crater in Arizona. Bless my soul, he said, I own that. I said, that's sort of what I suspected. Now, what I'd love to do, if it's all right with you, is put this phone on speaker, because I'm standing with all these tourists and there's the guide here, and he'd love to hear. He said, I'll give you a 2-second warning. I put him on hold. I said to the guide, would you mind stopping talking for a moment? You'll be interested in what you're going to hear off over this cell phone. He said, sure. He looked a bit bewildered. He didn't know what was coming up. So I then pressed the button. I said, okay, Minor, go ahead. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Minor Barringer. I'm sitting here in Chad's Ford, Pennsylvania, and I want to tell you that I'm the owner of the meteor crater that you have come to see today. And I just want to thank you on behalf of my wife and myself for all of you paying what I believe is $20, because it keeps me and my wife in jolly good champagne. I thought it was a lovely moment.
Well, I really enjoyed it when I read it, and that's the kind of thing that you find in your books, and also, you know, the footnotes. You find footnotes scattered throughout your book, and I'm the kind of reader who loathes footnotes.
You loathe them.
I do, but I find yours really entertaining. So in reading yours, there's a one or two or three that I find it's like, oh, I didn't really need that, but many of them add, you know, this kind of characterization that. You know, that really gives the...
Oh, it's a nice flavor. It's another little sidebar story that goes on.
Well, this all comes from Jan Morris, who you will know well, and Jan/James is my great sort of mentor, and I follow in many ways I try and follow her, and I still think she is just superb. But she loves footnotes and loves putting strange, quirky things that somehow don't belong in the book, in the body of the book, but just yearn to be out there. You just want people to know. I mean, if I can give you a good example of something from the book to come, I'm writing this book about an extraordinary man called Joseph Needham, who was an academic who wrote a big series of books about China. He was a communist, and he knew Mao Zedong very well. He also, when he was at Cambridge in the 1920s, drove a very fast car, a thing called an Armstrong Siddeley, open touring sports car. Anyway, 1953, Joseph Needham is in Beijing, and Mao telephones him and says, would you come over? I've got a matter of great national importance to discuss with you. And Joseph said, certainly, Mr. Chairman, I'll come to your study. So he went to Zhongnanhai and went to the great man's rooms. And the chairman said, well, Joseph, you're the only Westerner I know that knows a great deal about motor cars. So I need to ask you this question. Should I allow my people, he said, to drive motor cars, or should I urge them to remain with bicycles? And Needham said, well, Mr. Chairman, quite honestly, in Cambridge at the moment, I find a bicycle is perfectly adequate for all of my needs. Do you, Joseph? He said, well, in that case, bicycles it is.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, that is.
So that'll probably be in a footnote somewhere.
I would hope so.
Yeah, that worked. That deserves to be a footnote.
What is the title of your new book?
I had no idea what I'm going to call it.
Expect it to be out in a couple of years?
I know it'll be out for the Peking Olympics. It'll be out in spring 2008. I have to deliver it already, I'm beginning to think. Deliver it by June the 30th next year. Mm-hmm. I've got a year and a bit.
I have one last question. I think we probably need to let you go, but if you had to create a short list of books for aspiring writers or general readers to read, just a short list, what would be two or three of the titles that you would recommend people read?
Well, I certainly would include any one of Jan's portraits of cities. I think her book on Venice is peerless. So, Venice by Jan Morris. My favorite book, which is not as difficult as you might think. In fact, it's not difficult at all, but it's rather long and it's by a non-English person, is a book called Life, a User's Manual by a man called Georges, with an S, Perec, P-E-R-E-C. Georges Perec, who died in the 1980s, was a French Jew from Eastern Europe, essentially the same name as Peretz. And he's notorious for having written a book which he wrote in French, was called La Disparition. And it was translated into English under the title A Void. And in both the French version and also the English translation, he doesn't use the letter E anywhere. So he manages to write an entire book without using the letter E. He then wrote a book in French called Les Revenants, in which he only used the vowel E, didn't use any other vowels at all. That book proved untranslatable into English. But he also wrote this extraordinary book called Life, a User's Manual. And I come back to reading that once a year because I think that is the perfect book for the kind of jackdaw mind that I've got, you know, picking up odds and ends, full of footnotes, full of weird, wonderful things, eminently readable. It should, in my view, be on everybody's bedside table. It's the perfect, perfect book.
I have two more to end this with. I give my 8-year-old daughter, who thinks I get to do all kinds of wonderful things, which I do, and I ask her, what do you want me to ask Simon or whomever I'm into? So these are for my 8-year-old daughter. What did you have for breakfast this morning? And the second question is, when you're flying, do you like to sit next to the window, since you're a geologist, and do you like to look out the window?
I had for breakfast this morning, because it was quite early in New York, I had a cup of tea, English breakfast tea, and yogurt, as we call it in England, with honey that I made. I mean, the bees made, but it came from my farm, so that's all I had. And I love to, as predictably, until I find that I have to go to the loo an awful lot, and that may happen in another 5 years or so, I prefer to sit by the window, because in the Midwest I can amuse myself by counting the rate at which we're crossing the section lines, and then I know how fast we're going.
You know, I'm a
you do that too?
I'm a pilot.
Ah.
And that's exactly what I do. Because I know how big those things are, and I try to do the calculation. And then I cheat because I have a GPS with me and I can figure it out.
But what you have to do also is to know the angle at which you're crossing them. So then you have to do some basic geometry to work out if you're going at 45 degrees
across.
That's
when I take out the GPS. Right. One other thing about Mount Diablo, being a pilot, as a student pilot, Mount Diablo in aviation community is the poor man's GPS. No matter where you're flying on a reasonable day, you can see Mount Diablo. And if you can see Mount Diablo, you can get back to Palo Alto or wherever you're flying. So Mount Diablo absolutely is a very special mountain in the aviation community. If you go past it, you're out over the water, and that's bad.
Well, it was a very special mountain for me, too, yes. Because I think that's where I first saw San Francisco from.
Well, thank you, Simon. Thanks for sharing your time and your attention with us today. All best wishes for another great success with this book, and we'll look forward to the book on China.
Thank you very much indeed. This has been fun.
If you'd like to leave us email regarding tonight's podcast, drop us a line at ontheair@applausecast.com. If you'd like to have ApplauseCast produce a podcast for you or your organization, email us at sales@applausecast.com or call us at 650-400-3929. Thanks for listening.